This is the wired.co.uk podcast, your weekly guide to the important and the interesting, from science and tech to Lego and robotic cockroaches. This week, we have a veritable orgy of technology thanks to Apple's annual developer conference and the Sony Xbox face-off taking place at E3.
Plus, fancy controlling your own cockroach as if it were a remote control car. You'll have to snip off its antenna and stab it first.
And we delve into the US surveillance program Prism and whether we all need to leave the internet in order to be safe from prying eyes.
All that and more coming up.
Audible.co.uk is offering every listener of the Wired.co.uk podcast a free audiobook of your choice from a catalogue of over 80,000 titles. To claim yours now, go to audible.co.uk/wired and sign up for your free trial and your free book.
Hello, I'm your host Olivia_Solon and I'm the associate editor of Wired.co.uk.
I'm Liat Clark.
And I'm Kadam Schuber.
And this week we have two podcasts for you. Mega Wang.
Shock, horror. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Nate is in Los Angeles this week for the gaming extravaganza E3, so he'll be creating a special podcast for your oral pleasure. That's the AU oral, not the other one. Now, Nate's met up with a load of well-known games journalists to break down and discuss the news, as well as to hear questions about the Xbox price and online restrictions put straight to Xbox's European boss, and he does not go easy on him. But let's get cracking on this week's news. We can't really ignore Apple. Just generally, we can't ignore Apple, but this week they've had the Worldwide Developers Conference, the annual kind of Apple church service, if you will. And this is where all the Apple staff end up revealing what's in store for the next 12 months.
Did it blow your mind, Livia?
I don't know. Kadam and I reported on this. We stayed at work and it was interesting. I don't know if it blew my mind.
Yeah, I think a lot of it obviously was already expected, and they called the redesign radical, but...
So it didn't matter how often they said awesome and radical. It was
they said
still
awesome,
just
there should have been an awesome
predictable.
Check.
Yeah.
Tick, pa-ching. There were lots of things that were announced, but I'm going to start first of all with the latest version of the operating system. 10.9 is the number, but they've run out of cat names to call it. We've had Mountain Lion.
Come on. You know, they could have gone extinct cat species.
They don't have any moggies left. So they've gone and called it OS X Mavericks, because apparently it's a surf spot in California. I didn't know it.
I didn't know it either.
I just think of Top Gun.
But that's the new naming convention. But beyond the naming convention, they've also added a load of new features. And they made changes to ensure that it improves the battery life of the machines that run it, as well as CPU response times. They've also added some interesting features, such as an iCloud keychain, so your encrypted passwords for websites are transferable across devices. And they've also smartened up the calendar a bit, incorporating things like directions and weather for every little entry you make. And they've brought maps and iBooks to the desktop. And overall, there's a bit of more of a seamless experience between OS X and iOS, which is the mobile operating system. Next up, the big announcement. Well, at least they said it was the biggest change to iOS since the iPhone was introduced, which was a punchy claim from Tim Cook. But the biggest change, in my opinion, is the design aesthetic has changed. They've got rid of all the skeuomorphs, spiral bound bits on notepads, leather effects, the kind of green felt of the gaming centre. And it's all very kind of clean and flat. In fact, so clean and flat that everyone's saying it looks a bit like either Samsung's TouchWiz or Windows Phone. So it's nice, but there's a lot of people out there who are a bit upset that it lacks any kind of unique Apple character.
Doesn't look like the iPhone anymore.
I don't know. I think it looks quite good. It's very bright.
Yeah.
Like you said, it's very clean. And it has a sort of very pleasant and sort of upbeat feel to it.
Yeah.
One thing I don't understand at all is the parallax idea, where now you can see behind the apps. There isn't anything behind the apps to see. I have no idea why I need to have
that
feature.
Well, you can have your picture of your baby and then you can see peer behind your email app to see your baby's smiling face.
I guess so.
Oh, wow.
There we go. That's the ad right there. I've no need to worry, creative agency for Apple. There it is. But anyway, beyond the aesthetics, they've also introduced a pull-up control center, which is available from the lock screen, so you can adjust volume and brightness without unlocking the device. And there's also a major emphasis on multitasking without draining the battery. Siri's also been improved. You can now pick between a male and a female voice.
Whoa.
And they've integrated things like Wikipedia results and Bing search results, so you can bigot, as you will. The camera has hipster filters. Finally, Instagram, we no longer need. if you don't want to use it, but you can add now, you know, the kind of Polaroid effects over your photos should you so wish. And then what's interesting, I think, about the Photos app is that it automatically organizes pictures into moments using their metadata. So if you go on a holiday and you're in three different locations, it'll kind of group those pictures together automatically, which is quite a nice way of sorting stuff. And that's obviously going to be available in the autumn, but it's available now for developers. The interesting thing they did, which they don't often do, is they gave a sneak peek of a device, the Mac Pro.
Oh, yes, the new dustbin, tall Roomba.
That's an interesting way of describing it. Yeah, it does in fact look like a dustbin. The old Mac Pro towers were very big and blocky and silver, quite nice actually to look at. And this is now a kind of cylindrical device. I just went to go and see Apple today, and they were talking about how it doesn't actually have a back because it's a cylinder, but there is a back where you have all the inputs. But they're trying to go with that one. But yeah, it's a tiny device compared to the Mac Pro towers. It's an eighth of the size, at least it takes up an eighth of the space, but it's at least twice as powerful than its predecessors, and it has flash storage that's 10 times faster. So I think for professionals, you know, people working in the graphics industry, that is a big bonus. iRadio, Kadim, this was launched, this was expected, wasn't it?
Yeah, for a long time people have been talking about Apple's music streaming service, and it's not actually called iRadio, sadly.
No.
They went for iTunes Radio, which
It's going to be called iRadio.
iTunes Radio is far too long to say. So they only clinched a deal with Sony last week, it was reported, and it'll allow you to... It'll be built straight into your iTunes and also onto a music app on iOS 7. It'll be ad-supported and let you buy a song straight from the app by just clicking the price.
Yeah, and it's not really a Spotify competitor. It's going to be more like Last.fm or Pandora. It'll give you kind of, based on your interest, it'll give you a kind of radio, personalized radio station of music along those lines, a kind of discoverability tool, if you will. Now, it's already launched in the US, but it should be with us in autumn. This is like, they kept on saying, in the fall. It's like, that's, so we're not sure of a specific date, but we have that to look forward to. And very quickly, finally, the MacBook Air. They've made massive improvements to the battery life to both the 11-inch and the 13-inch versions, thanks to Intel's energy-efficient Haswell processor. So the 11.6-inch version, you now have 9 hours, whereas before you had 5 hours. And the 13-inch, you now have 12 hours, whereas before you had 7 hours. So that they are calling all-day power. And that is 10 hours of playback of movies as well, which is pretty impressive. So I think Nate can thank his crystal ball, because he correctly predicted all of these things last week, except for one thing, which was he suggested that the MacBook Airs might get a Retina display, which they didn't. But they did get performance improvements.
We just don't need the press conference anymore, do we?
That was it. You don't need to sit through 2 hours of lols. That's it right in a nutshell. But another major piece of tech news is a revelation that the US's National Security Agency has had access to our Facebook, Google, Yahoo, Skype and Apple accounts through a program called Prism. Kadim, this story's moved really, really quickly this week, but can you give us a roundup?
Yes, on the 7th of June, Guardian and Washington Post exposed this major surveillance program called Prism. They claimed that on that day that it could access everything you do online directly through Facebook, Google, Yahoo, etc.'s servers. But the story's changed a lot. Then the day after that, New York Times said, no, it wasn't direct access. It was sort of a Dropbox system. And on the 11th of June, it was reported that actually Google only give files either by hand, which I found very strange, or over secure FTP.
What does a file look like by hand?
I guess
a lot of printouts,
as in a USB stick.
Well, that's a difficult thing around this story. We've heard a lot about Prism and theoretically what it could do. We don't really know how it does what it does. There's not a lot of information about how it technically works.
Okay.
Google actually tells us this every year, how many times they've had a request from the government and how many times they've...
I don't know if this is included, though, is it?
Well, I don't know. I mean...
Or is this the mechanism through which they grant those requests?
Perhaps, that's the thing. We don't actually know, but...
There's different programs. And so with other programs, Google gives a breakdown of how many requests it gets.
Yeah.
But with Prism, that doesn't exist at the moment, and okay. Google isn't allowed to say.
Now, it was that it's been leaked by a whistleblower, right?
Yeah, his name is Edward Snowden, and he is a 29-year-old former contractor. He's obviously been fired now.
He got fired like 5 days after the event,
didn't fire
which was hilarious.
They didn't fire him immediately, which was optimistic of them, I thought. So he's fled to Hong Kong, where he was missing for a few days, but actually has now resurfaced, giving an interview to the South China Morning Post, I believe. He left a £130,000 a year job in Hawaii, left his girlfriend, who's since been blogging about how she feels, which is not great, obviously.
It's a really elaborate way of breaking up with your girlfriend, is what someone said on Reddit, I think.
What shocked a lot of people actually is that none of Prism, for example, is actually illegal. This isn't the U.S. government acting illegally. This is all authorized by certain laws. For example, the Patriot Act set the groundwork for a lot of this, and all the surveillance requests are theoretically approved by a secret surveillance court. The U.S., the president knew about it, Congress knew about it, and so on and so forth.
But isn't the kind of the key thing is here that although it's legal, most people weren't aware that it was happening. And in order to be able to find suspected terrorist activity or whatever the reasons they're giving to have this access, they need to be able to search everyone's stuff on the off chance that you then turn out to be the next kind of 9/11 bomber, for example.
Absolutely. And I mean, even aside from Prism, the NSA does, for example, tap into the major sort of internet tubes.
Into the tubes.
You also did like an octopus movement and like they're everywhere.
Yeah. And just records internet data en masse. Obviously some of that's encrypted and so on. But there was a poll done of Americans sort of recently after the news broke, and a majority of them, more than 50%, said that they're okay with the NSS looking through their private data if it protected against terrorism and so on.
I wonder how that was phrased.
Yeah.
You know.
Or also apathetic, wouldn't answer. I think it's because everyone assumes this is happening. It's just kind of like, well.
Absolutely.
Well, I think that's quite a lot of support.
But there's a lot more to come. Only five of around 43 slides have been released. The Guardian and the Washington Post say that the others are far too sensitive and contain technical details about how the NSA works. Also, thousands of other documents, which we don't yet know anything about, have been leaked to the Guardian, which we should be hearing more about. What will happen to Snowden is interesting in terms of whether he will be extradited from Hong Kong and how long that might take. And ultimately, Prism continues. There are some calls to have greater transparency about it, greater oversight over it, but it doesn't seem like this is a thing that's going to stop. The internet's here to stay.
You're already listening to the Wired.co.uk podcast, but you might have a friend who is less fortunate. Why not send them a postcard with wired.co.uk/podcast written on the back so they can join in?
Liat, now Lego characters' faces are a little bit less happy than they were when Lego launched.
I've actually been noticing this over the years, Olivia. And finally, someone has done a study to prove just that. Over the past 20 years, Lego faces have been getting mad. We're not sure why. But they're not really sure how, but they're angry, angry little men and women. A study done by the University of Canterbury mulled over the facial expressions of 3,655 Lego characters manufactured throughout the country, a company's history from 1975 up until 2010. This was basically because there's a heck of a lot of Lego out there. Apparently 75 pieces for every human on this planet.
That's why I keep stepping on them.
Yeah, always between my toes. So Canterbury University wants to ensure that our impressionable young are not being unduly affected by subliminal Lego messages. So they have analysed these Lego heads, and they identified from these 3,000 plus that there's 628 unique facial expressions, unique faces. And then these were then ranked according to what emotion they were expressing, ranked as kind of anger, disgust, fear, happiness, sadness, or surprise, and then how severe that emotion was. But you could have, you know, odd combinations like we do in life, like angry, surprised face. So there are many different outcomes, and I think the average was 3.9 emotions expressed by each head. So these are very complex little guys. You know, you should really not underestimate how much they can get across with one raised eyebrow. So they found that the majority are happy, actually.
Few.
Oh, that's good. They're being treated well.
There's a big but. So this was followed closely by anger and then sadness, disgust, surprise. And only 11 LEGO characters are afraid on this planet. I found fascinating. But anyway.
I feel like it's the other way around just for humans generally. Afraid,
we're
then
more
surprised,
afraid.
Disgusted, sad,
I know
angry,
what you mean.
And
oh,
maybe
that's
sometimes
awful.
A little bit happy.
Karen, that's awful. You just described my emotions through my day, my daily routine. Anyway.
Waking up afraid.
Sad. Yeah, just afraid of life.
Okay, so when were we angriest or happiest, in fact?
Well, it looks like we were probably happiest back in the 70s, which I couldn't believe.
If we look at LEGO as the benchmark of human
happiness. If we're
going
to look at that as a reflection for humankind, yes, definitely. So basically, over the years, they've been getting angrier. The number of angry faces has been increasing. Happy faces have been decreasing, to round up. And the spike actually began in the 90s, which is when they got really mad. And the team behind it actually think there is some correlation with warfare,
okay.
Unfortunately, because
LEGO warfare or
I think there might be a little bit of crossover. They just are reflecting the world around them and the wars we have been going through. So they have a lot of weapon systems that you can build. And the author came out as saying LEGO is moving towards a more conflict based play themes.
Okay, so maybe the NSA should be looking at LEGO, right?
Absolutely.
This is inciting
this is
terrorist
the crux
behavior
of all those angry people out there.
They shouldn't ditch my Facebook account. There's nothing of importance.
She
there.
Just posts unicorns and cats this time.
Right, yeah, okay. Right, well, we're going to take an ad break, but when we come back, we're going to talk about David Attenborough's new 3D nature series.
Wired magazine, now available every month on Amazon Kindle Fire, selected Android tablets, as well as the full range of iPads, from Retina display down to the iPad mini. Don't miss out. Subscribe today at wired.co.uk/magazine.
Welcome back. Now, before we get on with our regular segments, we have a very special report from Nate, who very recently met up with C.S. Wilson, the producer of David Attenborough's new Sky 3D nature series, Micro Monsters. He wants to find out about the technology and production methods behind the creepy crawly focus series ahead of its broadcast later this month.
It's time for insects. This month, David Attenborough's new series, Micro Monsters, will begin broadcasting on Sky 3D and Sky Atlantic in the UK. It's a three-part series that looks at some of the more unusual and creative inhabitants of the insect world, and presented in 3D, it makes for some pretty interesting footage. If you've ever wondered what a female praying mantis looks like while eating the top half of her mate, while the bottom half of her mate gets on with fertilizing her in 3D, this is your chance. But the series presented a number of technical challenges for the creative crew at Colossus Productions, both in terms of developing camera technology and also simply getting the insects to behave while being filmed. So I visited the show's producer, C.S. Wilson, to find out more, and I started by asking him when production for the series first began.
Well, in earnest, production started probably in August last year. We discussed making a series on insects with David Attenborough, and he was very keen on it, and there was a couple of solutions out there for us to go and look at and to use, things like the different cameras. What we'd actually happened across Jonathan about 2 years prior, when I was doing Flying Monsters, Jonathan got in touch with me. And he then said he's very keen and sent us some material in what she'd been shooting, and we brought it in here, put it up on the big screen, and my first feeling towards it was, oh no, what have we let ourselves in for? Because the 3D was just all over the place. It was really eye-popping stuff. But I could see that there was potential there, as could the guys here. Yeah. We then went back and I went out to Exeter. He also lives out in Exeter to visit Jonathan. And he revealed this piece of kit, which is called the Kubrick. So-called because it's named after Stanley Kubrick.
And this is sort of a pair of red sort of 4K type cameras paired together with a macro lens on the front.
That's pretty much it, yeah. Two lenses strapped on the side of a box which contains a prism which splits the light coming in down the single lens and then throws it off to the separate sensors in the camera. So essentially you're getting what your eye sees because you can get them really, really close which then allows you to get very close in on the macro. And some of our subjects, we were talking about things smaller than, well, some there we had ants which are size of grain, grains of sand. And if you imagine trying to put this big box, which is about 45 centimeters by about 20 centimeters deep over that, it's just going to cut out all your lights. It's going to diminish everything. So this finding this solution was fantastic, really.
And as far as I understand it, that's the first time that this sort of a solution has actually been used, certainly out in the field, I think.
Absolutely. The rig was invented 20-odd years ago, and they were strapping 16mm cameras to it. Not with much effect at all. What then happened is when they came along to us and we started developing it, we looked at it and we said, you know, what we want to do is we want a camera which can firstly film things the size of a pinhead. It needs to be robust, and it needs to do more than what we're getting on the beam splitters. But also we need to have it so that it's mobile and we can pick it up, sling it over our shoulder and trek into the middle of the jungle if we needed to.
How has 3D documentary making affected the editing process, either in time or in hardware?
When we first started on back with Flying Monsters and then subsequently with Micro Monsters, we found that putting a 3D monitor in the edit suite with the editors and the directors actually slowed things down, number one. Number two, the other thing that it did, and probably the most damaging thing that it did, was they stopped paying attention to the narrative, because the 3D was so enticing and so consuming and nearly hypnotizing. So we decided, actually, you know what, let's edit in 2D, and what we do at the end of each day, let's review in 3D. Now, in terms of the online post-production, that has become phenomenally protracted. A lot more time and effort needed in the post-production. There's far more time needed than what we need in a 2D show, or 2D documentary in particular. Because there's all sorts of things that appear in one eye and not in the other eye, so you've got to go and paint things out and clean them all up. You have to color grade for two eyes, so that's matching the colors and getting an overall look for your picture. That you do in 2D as well, but now you're doing it for the two eyes. You also need to do a thing which we call a depth grade, and that's basically looking at the material which was shot and then putting it in a form so that it's comfortable to watch, so we're not going all the way out of the screen and then going all the way back into the back of the screen, which is quite difficult on the eye. And if you're in a theater, a cinema, or watching television, and your eyes get a slight burning sensation, that's because your muscles are having to contract and release so often that it creates a lactic acid buildup. And that's what we aim to avoid.
Well, there was one instance which I understand will make the final edit, involving a couple of praying mantis. There's a scene where a praying mantis is approaching another praying mantis, and things didn't quite go as predicted.
Yeah, sure. It's there's a sequence in the show which was about reproduction. One of the episodes in the show is about reproduction. So what we've done is gathered a number of species and looked at interesting means of reproducing. We've got a scorpion doing a scorpion dance, and there were weevils which we had early on, and they have this ritual where they kind of have barbs at the end of their genitalia, and they cling together and they can't separate themselves. And this is all to aid the propagation of the species. So one of our subjects was the praying mantis, and we'd heard that praying mantis reproduction can be quite spectacular, and so we got it all set up and we had this little set going and had them habituated over a couple of days or so, and started working on it. Roll camera, the male advances on the female. And we had expected that they would then start having intercourse, and The next thing, the female turns around. She was at the top of this twig, turns around as the male's advancing, and just whacks him with her big paw, or a claw, and grabs him and starts eating him. And we thought that's a end of sequence. It was at the end of the day, so everybody's quite tired as well. And we just thought, well, that's the end of it. And we all started just about packing up, really. And there was quite a lot of disappointment actually in the studio as well. People said, right, that's it, let's it. And then Martin, our insect wrangler, he came over and he was looking at the monitor. And he pointed out that something else was going on. And in the throes of the female eating the male had was able to penetrate the female. And that's because the male mantis has a second brain, essentially, in its abdomen. It's able to separate the nerve cells from its brain in its head from the brain in or the nerve cells in its abdomen. And he was able to impregnate her, which was, it's something which has very rarely been caught on camera, and as far as I know, never been caught on camera.
That was Sias Wilson, producer of Micro Monsters, which begins its three-part series on Sky Atlantic and Sky 3D on Saturday the 15th of June at 8 p.m.
Thanks, Nate. And from one slightly ooh topic, we're going to go on to our first segment, which we are also going to start with ew. You can now buy a robo roach system, a robotic cockroach system, on Kickstarter.
Yes. I have to say, actually, that Kadam's words are echoing in my head because this story first made me afraid, then surprised, then disgusted, then wow. Angry. I didn't make you happy, really.
No. Oh.
Yeah. Okay. So, what is it?
So, Backyard Brains has launched this Kickstarter campaign to bring these remote controlled cockroach devices to the public. They're actually already sold through the company, but they want to raise funds so that they can stock buy the equipment and get them cheaper to the public and get educational materials and stuff. So the principle is actually pretty cool. It's a very clever system designed to get those that perhaps never considered neuroscience as a career to learn and get excited about science in a pretty fascinating way. The kit consists of this little backpack that you fit with electrodes, and this is attached to the cockroach's back and to its antenna. Now, these little guys usually use their antenna to navigate around objects as feelers. You know, as soon as they feel an object, they switch directions. But these guys at Backyard Brains have developed an app that you can sync up via Bluetooth to the electrodes on its back, which are sending small electrical pulses to direct it left or right. So you can just sit there on your phone going left, right, left, right, and just watch him go nuts.
So you can literally use a cockroach like it was a remote control car.
Yeah. Until awesome. Apparently they're pretty savvy and they pick up on it after a while and they just ignore you and tune you out, which I think is great. But there was even an art project last year that we covered where there was apparently a social commentary on how we're all desensitized. It involved letting the public control a cockroach's movements left and right via Twitter. Nobody knows what happened to that cockroach.
So these backpacks, these are just, you know, these guys are just wearing them, you know, with straps.
No, Kadam.
No?
Sadly not. Oh. Now, they kind of skim over the ins and outs of what they're calling the neuro revolution, and that is you have to stab the guy in the back through his exoskeleton, stick a wire through there, super glue the backpack on, cut the antennas off, stuff electrodes in, glue them on there, some hot glue.
That's horrific.
So it suddenly comes a bit less fun. Oh, here's my app to control a little insect to I'm now slightly bullying a small creature.
Yeah, yeah. Making him go left, right. I mean,
even though it's a cockroach, I mean, we don't really like cockroaches.
I mean, I hate cockroaches and I was pretty upset about this.
But now that you spoke to the founders, we need to kind of give them the right to reply. What do they say?
Now, this guy, he was very much about cockroach safety. They don't like to kill the cockroaches. They don't kill the cockroaches. They're only used for about a week and then they're retired. That's what he says. He says they go and make babies and they live for 2 to 3 years. But I didn't get a chance to ask him what exactly they do without their antennas. I'm not sure I would find a cockroach a suitable mate if he could not. navigate well.
I always look for long antennas on my potential suitors.
Well, exactly. You walk in a straight line. So apparently the system... No, I don't have anything against people that can't walk in a straight line. I'm just thinking of a cockroach.
It's all right.
So apparently the system's only used for a few minutes at a time, and the cockroach adapts fairly quickly and ignores it. And he actually, his argument is, getting people to do this actually makes them think about the ethics of neuroscience and when it's okay to experiment on animals and when it's not with neural interfaces. But I think this is a little bit confusing because you're basically telling them, do this as experiment and then think about the consequences, which I'm pretty sure is not the way you go about a clinical study.
I don't think it is a clinical study.
But I'm saying if you're encouraging people to get into a career in science, and this is amazing and you should do this.
There should be more ethical considerations.
Yeah, bit backwards.
And also it's all very well for them to, you know, be careful about how they install the equipment on the cockroach and so on and only use it for a few minutes. But if you're telling everyone to do it,
exactly.
I mean, what age is the kid going to be when they're doing it? And I mean, maybe I don't want to use it for a few minutes. Maybe I want to sit all day.
Well, exactly.
And maybe the video that shows you how to install the kind of control equipment is actually protected on YouTube for being a bit gruesome, isn't it?
I don't think I've ever read a video where I had to say, yes, don't worry, I accept that I might be disturbed by this content.
If you've been affected by any of the issues raised on this week's podcast, why not tell us about them? The team is waiting for your comment at facebook.com/wiredUK.
Now, our final segment is What's Up With Space? Now, what is up with space? Sadly, it's no longer Chris Hadfield because he's retired. Now, astronaut Chris Hadfield has been in the International Space Station for a while, and he became a little bit of an internet celebrity.
A little bit.
A lot of it. He developed about a million Twitter followers in the time that he was up there. And sadly, he's announced that he will be retiring on the 3rd of July, retiring from the Canadian Space Agency after his incredible adventure. Now, he says he's going to pursue new professional challenges with private companies. And I'm not sure if this means private space companies or just kind of consulting in the aerospace sector generally, or just doing lots of highly paid talking speaking engagements.
This guy's going to make a killing.
But he also needs to recover from the physical costs of living in space. Microgravity can lead to muscle loss, sleep cycle disruption, motion sickness, and space flashes. This is when bullets of space radiation travel through your retina, it's been said that they contribute to cataracts. So he needs some relaxy time. Yeah. But I thought it'd be a really good opportunity to think about our favourite Chris Hadfield moments, because obviously he was sending tweets the whole time, videos, photos. So I'm going to start with Liat.
Mine is just uber cheese because I love Bowie and I love space and I love Space Oddity, and I'm trying to figure out a way that it's appropriate that I can walk down the aisle to it this year because it's just the best song ever. And
I don't see why you need a reason.
It's not very romantic. Hadfield performing this with his sultry tones, his long stares into space back at the planet was just a mystical moment for me in all its cheesy glory.
You're marrying the wrong man.
Yeah, you need to open your wedding ceremony. It was like, I'll be your ground control if you'll be my Major Tom.
Holy nice. Crap.
Right in there.
I think we might attend a draft there's something similar.
Mine is, they had a great video showing how astronauts sleep in space, and it looks massively uncomfortable. It's kind of upright. You have to tie yourself in. And there's an interesting aspect whereby the airflow has to be circulated quite intensely around the sleeping astronaut, because otherwise they can kind of pass out because the carbon dioxide that they're exhaling kind of builds up around them.
Oh my God.
So I thought that was kind of interesting.
See, I love that one. It's super interesting. But the reason I don't like it so much is because it meant I could never be an astronaut because... it looks really claustrophobic.
Just one of the reasons why you will never be an astronaut.
That is the only reason. Okay.
And it's not really a moment. I had one more thing, but his moustache. I mean, just the most famous moustache. The moustache of the moment, I'd say.
Yeah. Most famous moustache in space.
True. Like that. Now, Kadim, what's your favourite?
Mine is really sort of mundane after those two. If you remember when he was explaining how you make sandwiches on the International Space Station, A, I love that for the idea of making sandwiches in space.
Yeah.
And B... So they don't make sandwiches using normal bread. They have to use tortillas. Otherwise, you'll make lots of crumbs. I just love when he pulls it from the packet and he just lets it hang there.
Yeah.
Like, this is my tortilla. What are you going to do about it?
Deal with it.
Exactly.
He's got some serious style there, man.
I mean, that's kind of pretty much all the videos of what you're doing in space. You just pop it out. leave it floating.
Just like
his,
look at this,
his Nikon camera.
Yeah.
But that's all we have time for today. We actually have some feedback we got sent to podcast@wire.co.uk from a guy called Jeremy Pearson. Now, in last week's episode, episode 127, we were talking about whether web giants like Google need to be doing more to combat child pornography. Now, Jeremy has pointed out that the watchdog on these issues, the Internet Watch Foundation, finds the use of the term child porn unacceptable. In a statement, the IWF says that they use the term child sexual abuse content to accurately reflect the gravity of the images we deal with. Please note that child pornography, child porn and kiddie porn are not acceptable terms. The use of such language acts to legitimise images which are not pornography, rather they are permanent records of children being sexually exploited and as such should be referred to as child sexual abuse images. Now, I think this is a really good point and it's something we should definitely consider changing the wording of our articles going forward. So thank you, Jeremy. Liat, how can people get in touch with us?
Well, Olivia, you can follow us as ever on Twitter. We're at Wired UK. We've also got our trusty Facebook page, or email us on podcast@wired.co.uk.
Thank you very much and we'll see you next week.
You've finished this week's episode of the Wired.co.uk podcast. Until next week's episode, why not download the latest issue of Wired on your iPad, Android tablet or Kindle Fire? Do so with a discount from wired.co.uk/magazine.